The difference 40 miles makes today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 40 miles is all that separates Tel Aviv from Jerusalem. But if President Trump decides to move the U.S. embassy from one to the other,
the Palestinians have said that effectively ends the U.S. role in the peace process. And it'll probably get some very bad blowback from others in the Arab world.
Also, Kim Chakanetsa grew up in Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. She benefited from good schools and a decent economy. Then it all fell apart.
Seeing this country that I love so much suddenly take this downturn, that was very hard.
Plus, we have the story of a woman who left Thailand looking for economic freedom and ended up in a sweatshop in L.A.
When I arrived, there's no such thing as freedom.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. An extraordinary day in the sports world. Russian athletes banned from the Winter Olympics, so says the International Olympic Committee, and we will fill you in on that a bit later. We start, though, by taking a look at the tag on the back of your shirt or the back of your coat. Who made it and where? Probably made by a woman and probably not here in the U.S. This week, our Women's Lives team is bringing us the stories of women in the garment industry, the ones who make our clothes. Today, we stop in California to learn what a Made in America label can actually mean. The world's Jasmine Garz has our story from Los Angeles.
Over 20 years ago, Chancy Martorell was driving down this same exact highway. It was 4 a.m., she was headed to the Yum Yum Donut Shop in El Monte, east of Los Angeles, and she was worried about what was about to go down. A raid on a sweatshop, and the owners could turn violent.
They had weapons, so they had to make sure they didn't use their weapons.
Waiting for her at the donut shop was the El Monte Police Department, the U.S. Marshals, and the California Labor Department. Chancy says when she was first contacted for this assignment,
and I said, wow, guess what? I am not surprised. It's about time that it surfaces.
Chancy runs the Thai Community Development Center, a nonprofit. She says she'd heard enough rumors to know. Sooner or later, the authorities were going to uncover something bad. What's left of the American garment industry is mostly in Los Angeles, and it feeds off of cheap immigrant labor. But Chancy couldn't have imagined just how bad. The apartment complex on Santa Anita Avenue in El Monte was holding 72 slaves, mostly women from Thailand, women like Rochana Sussman. Growing up, this was not the America Rochana had imagined.
Just take those old records off the shelf. I sit and listen to them by myself.
I heard about one guy, Tom Cruise. He's so handsome.
Rochana grew up very far away from here, in the 80s, on a bamboo farm in central Thailand. When she talks about her town back home, that's when she really lights up.
It was very peaceful. All I see is every day is a mountain, the sunrise, and the field, the rice field.
It was beautiful, but the money was in the city. Rural girls like Rochana flocked to the garment factories, but they worked long hours for low pay. One day in 1993, when she was 24, Rochana was approached by an acquaintance who told her, listen, why not do the same work but for so much more in America?
He said, oh, you're going to make like $1,000?
$1,000 a month. That's three times what she could make in Thailand. There was a catch. Between visa fees and airfare, Rochana would owe her new employer $5,000. But she figured, I'll pay it off and save the rest. So she said, yes, take me to Los Angeles.
But when I arrived, there's no such thing as freedom.
As soon as Rochana got to El Monte, she realized something was off.
It was barbed wired at that time we got there. There's a bodyguard, security guard, they all 24 hours, 7.
Barbed wire, armed security guards. This was not the America she had been promised.
They start, take the passport, let me hold it for you.
At the apartment complex, the downstairs garages had been converted to sewing rooms. The rooms above, where the workers slept, locked from the outside. Rochana started working almost right away.
7 a.m. Normally we finish everything clean up by 1 a.m. 7 to 1 a.m.
18-hour shifts. The windows were boarded up and she rarely saw the light of day. They got paid about $400 a month. They were told they had to pay back those $5,000 they owed for visas and travel.
We all got really, really sick. A lot of us get the tuberculosis.
Were you allowed out at all?
No, not at all.
Every morning, the garage doors of El Monte opened. Just a crack. Not enough for anyone to escape, but wide enough to push out bags of newly made clothing. The clothing got sent to a front factory located in downtown Los Angeles, where name-brand retailers would purchase them. A couple of the workers, they managed to escape. And one of them, she eventually told a boyfriend, and he told authorities, "Hey, there's a place east of Los Angeles you need to go to. They have slaves." On the night of August 1st, 1995, at around 1 a.m., Rochana Sussman sewed her last stitch and went to sleep. As Rochana was sleeping, Chancy Martorell was getting in her car and driving down that highway to the Yum Yum Donut Shop. Her role was to help the authorities speak to the Thai workers held captive.
The U.S. Marshals and El Monte Police told us that they would come in here first because they've identified the last building being the living quarters of the perpetrators, the traffickers, the employers, and that they would secure that one first. And they would apprehend those people first because those are the folks with weapons.
All the way back there.
All the way back there.
At the site of the raid, Chancy Martorell remembers every detail from that night, down to the first door she knocked on.
First door that passed the garages?
The door Rochana was behind.
And then it was like 4 a.m., I think. I heard the knock on the door. Oh, at that moment, you're just like shaking, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And I heard all the voice from Chancy, "We're here to help you."
We're here to set you free.
The photographs of the El Monte raid show a group of haggard women lined up and crouching up against a wall. Their hands cover their mouths and their gaze is distant. They look terrified. The sun was rising over Los Angeles. Rochana Sussman had been here for a year and a half, and she had never seen that before. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Los Angeles, California.
Wow. Jasmine Garst joins me now to discuss the aftermath of the El Monte case. So, Jazz, what happened to the people who were holding Rochana and the 71 other Thai garment workers?
It was a family that was running this clandestine factory. The ringleader was this Thai grandmother, and she was running it with her five sons. Two of them ran away when they saw the authorities coming in this bust. The other ones pled guilty. They got several years in prison. They had to pay $4.5 million to the 81 workers. All of the people who were being held against their will, they all got citizenship eventually, except for two who opted to go to Thailand. And Rochana, she married, she had a family, she's doing wonderfully.
How did this whole incident change laws?
So this is a really pivotal moment in American labor history in which it's understood that there are incidents of slavery in modern America since slavery was abolished. And it's also understood that these kinds of sweatshops aren't just abroad. Because when people say sweatshop, you don't think LA, right? You think Bangladesh, you think China. You don't think Los Angeles. And in the end, all this leads to the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act, which authorizes protection for undocumented immigrants who are victims of this type of severe trafficking and human rights violations. And it allows them to come forward and not be afraid of deportation.
So this is progress. This all happened in 1995, though. What is the industry in Los Angeles like today?
As a result of this, there's definitely a heightened awareness. There's a creation of the Apparel Industry Partnership, which is now the Fair Labor Association. The garment industry left the U.S. It went abroad, mostly to Asia. And what remained mostly is in Los Angeles. And it very much relies on undocumented labor. And I actually met with a woman. Her name is Hilda.
Pues empecé cortando hilos. Empecé ganando un centavo.
Hilda is like a classic LA sweatshop story. She was an artisanal weaver back in Guatemala. She gets here, she's undocumented, and things got rough pretty fast. So she starts off as a thread cutter, and she got paid 1 cent for every two pants.
1 cent for every two pairs of pants. It's incredible.
She says nowadays you can get 6 cents for one pair of pants.
Still bad. but what recourse do people have?
You know, California does try to enforce this, the labor laws. You know, and the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act, it allows immigrants who are undocumented to feel comfortable coming forward and reporting something like this. You know, what activists and advocates say is that with this administration, with the amount of xenophobia, with the amount of anti-immigrant rhetoric, if there was another El Monte, would those people come forward?
Yeah, really interesting question. Jasmine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Jasmine Garz, reporter for the World's Across Women's Lives desk. This week, her team is bringing you stories about the women who make your clothing across the world. Tomorrow, we follow the team to Bangladesh. Also tomorrow, she wrote the book on fast fashion. Elizabeth Klein will be joining Jasmine for a Facebook Live. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern. And we'd love to get your questions for Elizabeth. You can find more details at our Across Women's Lives Facebook page. What will the Winter Olympics be without the Russian flag? According to the International Olympic Committee, more dope-free, for one thing. The IOC today banned the Russian team from the Winter Games, coming up in February in Pyeongchang, South Korea. The ban follows an investigation into alleged state-sponsored doping by Russia. The World's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. So what did we learn today, Charles? What measures is the IOC taking?
Well, the IOC came out with an investigation that they hadn't published previously. So they discussed it among their committee. They invited the Russian Olympic Committee to review the results. And it came out with this gangbuster finding. They said no Russian anthem will play. The Russian team is suspended from the Olympic Games. They're banning all Russian sporting officials. This is including the former sports minister, the Russian Olympic Committee head, among others. Moreover, the record books will show that zero medals were won for Russia. They are leaving, however, up a window open for clean athletes from Russia to sort of go through a pre-games testing task force, which would allow them to, in theory, participate in the games and would reward the clean athletes for a chance to participate, but again, under a neutral flag.
That neutral flag would be the Olympic flag. How do you think Russian athletes will feel about competing under that flag? I mean, they've done all this training, but they can't compete for their country. How nationalist are they?
That's right. Technically, the athletes would be identified as Olympic athlete from Russia, OAR. So Russian athletes in the build-up to this moment today were saying essentially that they didn't want to go if they weren't going to be representing Russia as their country. We'll see what happens. You know, I think a lot of them were hoping for some kind of miracle today. They didn't get it. And we'll just have to see what they decide going forward.
And as to the question of whether the doping in Russia was state-sponsored, what did the committee say?
So we heard from Thomas Bach, the head of the IOC, who said this was an unprecedented attack on the Olympics by Russia. He said that the evidence here was not just by this Russian whistleblower we've heard about, this Grigory Rodchenkov, who fled Russia for the United States and once ran Moscow's anti-doping laboratory. The Russians say that this guy is lying all the time, but the Olympic Committee said they essentially had forensic evidence that showed that the evidence of doping and systemic doping was just overwhelming.
I mean, Russians aren't the only ones who dope, but they seem to be the most flagrant. Will this move by the IOC actually serve to slow down doping?
That's a big question. The point that the Russians make all the time is that, yes, doping is a problem in Russia, but it's not just Russians who dope. And they've been against all along this idea of collective punishment. And so it'll be interesting to see if this has any effect. It was also noted among the penalties issued today by the IOC was one more, which required Russia to reimburse the IOC for its investigations to the tune of $15 million. And that money would go towards strengthening the anti-doping efforts by the IOC going forward. The real question is now what Russia will do. We had a statement by Putin's spokesman today who said that Russia was not considering an all-out boycott. But Vladimir Putin has also said that this was essentially politics at play. He said that this was done to embarrass him ahead of the presidential elections, which Russia holds in March of 2018. And this was done by the United States as payback for the alleged Russian interference in our elections in the U.S.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks as always, Charles.
Thanks, Marco.
Growing up in Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, it wasn't all bad. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Let's get back to Zimbabwe for the next few minutes. It's been nearly 2 weeks since Robert Mugabe resigned. He ruled Zimbabwe for 37 years, ever since the end of the country's anti-colonial struggle in 1980. That means most Zimbabweans grew up in a world dominated by Mugabe. My BBC colleague Kim Chakanetsa grew up as a kid in the early years of Mugabe's rule. So, Kim, you are one of those Zimbabweans, and there are many who have known Mugabe and no other leader?
Absolutely. All I remember was growing up, seeing him everywhere, really, because his image can be found in school hallways, it can be found in hospitals. And I remember asking my mother if Mugabe was a relative, just because we had this photo of him in our office in the shop that my parents owned. They had two images, one in the main office and one in the shop building. And it was just a sign of the reverence that people had for Mugabe at the time. He was this real liberation hero.
What were your earliest memories of Mugabe as the country's leader?
I remember seeing him on the news quite a bit because there was a lot going on. This was a period of real prosperity. So new schools were being opened. And so he was always attending these ceremonies. So I'll see him on the news. And my father, who had met Mugabe when he was younger, my father was in boarding school and Mugabe had come to the boarding school to tell them about self-rule, that self-rule is coming, that independence is coming. And my father had this real admiration for Mugabe because he said he was such a charismatic man. And so I used to see him through the eyes of my father, who was so pleased that this man he had met was now leading the country, just as he had promised when he had come to his boarding school.
When Mugabe would appear on TV, how did your father behave when he saw him?
Oh, he'd always take us back to that moment when he met him and just talk about, this man who is a man who keeps his promises. And we had many conversations over the years as things started to change. And he was one of the first people I wanted to speak to when Mugabe finally resigned, because I just wanted to hear his reaction. Because over the years, the relationship has changed, and he became very bitterly disappointed in Mugabe.
We'll get to that in a moment. But first, let me ask you, when did your opinion begin to change about Mugabe?
It's one of those things that I've wrestled with over the years, because I was one of those people who was fortunate enough to benefit from his more positive legacy in terms of schools. The literacy rate in Zimbabwe is very high. So I went to school and I had access to the very best education system, to the very best healthcare system. I really had no issues growing up. So for me, seeing things take a turn in the sort of 2000s, that was very difficult because it's this
thing. That
was
a really rough economic period for Zimbabwe.
Extremely rough economic period, especially in 2008, where hyperinflation was extreme, extreme. I think it went to 231 million in July 2008,
right,
if you can imagine that. But seeing this country that I love so much suddenly take this, downturn, that was very hard. And knowing that this person who had been responsible for some of the best years of her life was also responsible for some of the most difficult years of my life and those of my family and friends.
How did this affect everyday life?
It became very difficult, and it's one of those things that you can't quite imagine. I remember one particular incident, going into a pharmacy and trying to buy some medication with my sister and having to go away because we need a change. And when I came back, the price had gone up in the space of an hour and a half. And
wow.
I know that sounds ridiculous, but that was the nature of how crazy things were.
So, Kim, now it's 2017. Mugabe is out. How did you hear he was stepping down? And how did that feel?
I was at work, but I was in the studio, so my phone was off. And then I switched it off just to check the news, because it was a very fraught time. I was keeping a very close eye on the news. When I saw that he had resigned, it just felt so momentous. I just had to switch off my phone and just take a moment to just absorb what that meant. And obviously, of course, I called everyone after that
Did you call your dad, and did you have that discussion?
I did.
So what did you talk about?
My dad, he's very pragmatic. So he was then on to the next concern, which was what comes next. Is this man, the new leader, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is he good for the country? What can he do for the country? And how do we not repeat the mistakes of the past?
So he did gain some perspective on who Robert Mugabe really was.
Exactly. And I think just to see Robert Mugabe of 1980, if you just sort of trace his trajectory, you see the Robert Mugabe of 1980, the statesman who was very reconciliatory in his approach. And then to sort of see the turn he took And the language, I think, became very interesting. He started talking about Zimbabwe as if it was his country. You talk about, you know, his arch nemesis, Tony Blair, at the time. There's a famous quote when he says, "Blair, keep your England, I'll keep my Zimbabwe." And that line, "my Zimbabwe," became one of the things that I found most alarming, that it's almost as if the country belonged to him and he had the right to do whatever he wanted to the country.
The new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, says he's eager for a new start, but his career with Mugabe goes back to the 70s. How do you and your friends and family feel about the future?
I try to be cautiously optimistic, but if I'm frank, he has been at Mugabe's side for a very long time. What I am clinging on to is that Emmerson is also a very practical man. He knows that the country cannot continue the way it is going, that certain things have to change. And already he's making some of the right noises. But what this translates into in terms of whether Zimbabwe is going to become a fully free and fair country when it comes to elections, where people can vote for whoever they like and they know that their vote will be counted and the election won't be rigged. Whether that will actually happen, I don't know. I mean, for me, the true test is the elections coming up next year. If those can be without violence and free and fair, then, you know, we would have made giant steps.
Describe the future you want for Zimbabwe, Kim. Like, what conditions would you need to go back?
Oh, I would go back in a heartbeat because it's home. And I think a lot of people feel that they are living as second-class citizens in South Africa, in Botswana, Zambia, England, wherever they prefer to
all
be
the Zimbabweans
at home.
Zimbabwe, who've fled.
Exactly,
yeah.
Who've fled. But there's just no work at the moment. And a lot of things just don't work. Turning on a tap, sometimes you go for without water for weeks, months. Electricity is very erratic. So these basic things that...
Yeah, I mean, jobs and infrastructure, two very basic things.
Exactly, exactly. So without those in place, it makes it very hard to consider how you could go back and live. But I'm feeling very hopeful because I think Zimbabweans really would like to see their country back on its feet.
My BBC colleague, Kim Chakanetsa, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. The Supreme Court says President Trump's travel ban can go into full effect. It affects visitors from six Muslim-majority countries, and for some, it is devastating.
To be honest, it's emotional for me because the belief that I've always had in this country is really being tested.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's not a sure thing yet, but President Trump is expected to announce plans tomorrow to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the U.S. embassy there. Today in Washington, his advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, said Trump is still thinking about it.
He's still looking at a lot of different facts, and that when he makes his decision, he'll be the one to want to tell you, not me. So he'll make sure he does that at the right time.
Diplomats are urging Trump not to do it. They warn that recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital would undermine peace efforts and Trump's credibility in the region. Senior Palestinian official Nabil Shaath agrees.
That totally destroys any chance that he will play a role as an honest broker. That takes away honest, takes away broker, takes away chaperone of peace, takes away the deal of the century.
I asked Daniel Kurtzer for his perspective. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and Israel, now a professor of Middle East policy at Princeton.
First of all, both Israel and the Palestinians claim Jerusalem as the capital of their states. And the United States, as a third party that has always been interested in trying to achieve a settlement, would be taking a unilateral step to support the position of one side over the other. So it doesn't make any sense from a diplomatic standpoint. It may resolve some of the administration's internal political issues, but in doing so, it would effectively end the U.S. role in trying to broker a peace settlement.
just to play devil's advocate, I mean, Israel recognizes Jerusalem as its capital, just like Washington is the capital of the U.S. We all learn that in school. So why shouldn't Trump call the capital what it is?
You know, just a short note of history. In 1948, it would have made sense for the United States to do that because Israel occupied the western part of the city. Jordan occupied the eastern part of the city. But the U.S. didn't do it. After 67, when Israel took over the entire city, it expanded the boundaries and applied its sovereignty throughout the city. So saying that the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital could be confused with recognizing all of what Israel did in 1967 by expanding the boundaries and annexing the territory. And that's what made it more complicated. So today, it's not an easy problem simply to say that because Israel declares Jerusalem its capital, the U.S. should do the same thing.
Do any other countries have this debate about where their embassy should be and what the recognized capital of Israel is?
No, not today. A few years ago, there were a couple of Latin countries that did in fact maintain an embassy in Jerusalem, but that changed for lots of different reasons, not the least of which was a kind of feeling that it was supporting the occupation in some way, that it wasn't helping advance the prospects for peace.
What will reaction to this be from Palestinians?
You know, nobody knows. It could run the gamut from a yawn, which is, you know, we know the United States is biased, so what difference does this make, to violence. It could bring people out on the street. Anything that touches Jerusalem also impacts Muslim attitudes around the world. We saw that with that minor event when, you remember, two Israeli security guards were shot outside the Temple Mount and Israel put up magnetometers, and it created riots all over the world. This could create an even bigger reaction.
And presumably Prime Minister Netanyahu is pleased with this announcement. Explain why.
For his base, this is a recognition of Israel's claim to all of Jerusalem. That's the way they'll interpret this.
Previously, the Palestinians saw their right to East Jerusalem, at least.
At least, yeah. In other words, some division of the sovereignty over the city. And therefore, Netanyahu will chalk this up as a major victory in which the Israel's biggest ally, most important ally, the United States, has, in his view, finally come around to accepting the reality of Israel's claim in Jerusalem.
Do you think Trump, maybe at the last minute, could kind of addend the deal by saying we're just looking for West Jerusalem?
I would be pretty sure that that's what he'll try to say, but it still ends up being a unilateral move because there's no definition of what West Jerusalem is. Israel is claiming all of Jerusalem and has built settlements, neighborhoods on the eastern side of the city. So, you know, saying West Jerusalem has no particular meaning right now.
Would it have any meaning symbolically if he were to say that?
I think that's what he would hope that it would have. My guess is they're trying to find wording that conveys the idea that we recognize Jerusalem, but that we're not precluding the possibility of a peace settlement on Jerusalem. And they're going to try to square that circle, but this is not a circle that's easy to be squared. You know, no circle is.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel there, Daniel Kurtzer, on what's at stake with President Trump's decision on Jerusalem. Now on to another controversial decision, this one already taken by the president. Over the weekend, his administration said it wants to pull out of the U.N. Migration Compact. This was an agreement that President Obama signed onto last year. The world's Shirin Jafari is here to tell us more. So what is this all about, Shirin?
If you haven't been stranded on a desert for the past year or so, Marco, you'd know that the world is facing major migration. There are a lot of people on the move. There's the war in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and there are people who leave their countries looking for work.
Right, and we have to remember that a lot of people who are on the move don't even make it to their destinations. Just look at all the images and videos of people clinging to capsized boats in the Mediterranean.
Right. And so given all that, last year, a group of countries came together at the UN. They sharpened their pencils and said, let's come up with some ideas that we all agree on and that we can help the migrant situation. And they did it. You know, representatives from these countries, they hammered out a declaration. It's called the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. And they were pretty excited about what they came up with.
The New York Declaration on Refugees and Migrants is once in a lifetime chance. If you go back to 1948, when the Universal Declaration on Human Rights was adopted, at the beginning people thought, well, this is just an aspirational document, it doesn't have much value. And what it did, it revolutionized human rights. And I think we hope that the New York Declaration on Refugees and Migrants will do exactly the same.
That voice you heard is Walker Turk. He's the Assistant High Commissioner for Protection at the UNHCR, which is the UN Refugee Agency.
So what is in this declaration? What did it actually say?
So while the UN and the countries involved in the agreement were, you know, patting each other on the back, others didn't really see much concrete action in the document. They said, yes, there's empathy and recognition that there is a problem, but there really isn't any concrete steps. And some of the issues that the document talked about was, for example, rights for refugees and migrants. It said that countries shouldn't detain immigrant children. It also said they should make sure refugees and migrant children get education when they come to a new country. So those are some of the things that the document talked about. There was also an idea to start a campaign to fight racism and discrimination against migrants and refugees. But it wasn't all about refugees and migrants. The document called for support for the host countries, the countries that take in those migrants and refugees. That's something that hadn't been talked about a lot before on an international stage and in a larger context. So that was new.
I mean, it's an interesting proposal. It's basically a bill of rights for refugees and migrants, kind of reasonable ideas, especially in this time. Why does the U.S. say it doesn't want to be part of this anymore?
It's not completely clear why the U.S. is quitting the New York Declaration and the U.N. talks. It's a bit ironic given that the, you know, document is called the New York Declaration. The timing of the U.S. pullout is also interesting. The U.S. said it's not going to be part of this just hours before there was going to be another follow-up discussion in Mexico. Mm. But Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., said that one reason is that the U.S. likes to make decisions about immigration policies by itself. She said that, you know, Americans want to be able to make decisions on their own. Just to be clear, the declaration was never going to be holding any country legally responsible. It was non-binding. But the idea was for these countries to say, okay, we know that migration is only going to increase over the next years, you know, with wars, climate change, and so on. We know that people are dying trying to make it to these countries. So let's come up with ideas. Let's talk about this. Let's start a conversation and see if we can help these people.
So what happens now, Sharon, with this group of 200 countries? They met, they came up with this document, but minus the U.S.
I mean, the first question the international community is going to be asking is, can we go into future negotiations with the U.S. if they're going to be pulling out of agreements left and right? Since President Trump came into office, the U.S. has pulled out of the U.N. Climate Change Treaty, for example, as well as UNESCO, which is the cultural arm of the U.N. But the U.S. boycott doesn't really mean that the conversation is going to stop. Other countries will go ahead with these discussions. They're just going to be doing this without the presence of the U.S., which is the richest and most powerful country in the world.
More power to them, but the U.S. sure could help, I think. The world, Shirin Jafari, thank you.
Sure thing, Marco.
Here's another thing President Trump's been trying to do since he came into office, fully implement his travel ban. And yesterday, the Supreme Court gave his administration the green light, even as legal challenges against the measure continue. The court's decision affects travel by residents of six mostly Muslim countries, and for many, it's not just a news story. It's personal and it's painful. Ask Afaf Nasher. She directs the New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She's also a daughter-in-law, and the new restrictions mean a central figure in her family won't be permitted to visit the U.S.
He really is the one that brings the entire family together, that takes care of others.
She's describing her children's grandfather, who now won't be allowed to come to the U.S. to see his grandkids.
My father-in-law is an elderly man. He's about 80 plus years old, and he's experiencing health issues, and he's needed care more than once. But he's in Yemen. He's a Yemeni national. We really just want to see him live out his final, whatever it is, years, hopefully. Hopefully he has many years to come. But we want to see him do so with his family beside him.
Right. And Yemen is on this list. So your father-in-law has made several trips to the U.S. previously to see your extended family in years past. What will this mean for his health?
Well, it's pretty dramatic, to be honest with you. I'll tell you the background on the situation. He left Yemen, and which was treacherous in and of itself. He left Yemen several weeks ago to go to Egypt because he needed urgent care. As you know, there is increased instability in Yemen. Literally, bullets are flying out of windows. And so for him to travel from the capital in the north, which is Sana'a, to go all the way to the south and catch some sort of boat, which brings him into another country so he can finally get into Egypt for urgent care, when you're sick, was a huge problem and something that we were really concerned about. And what we'd like to do is to bring him in here through a visa. And my husband and I were talking about what we can apply for. And just hours later, we heard about the Supreme Court's decision. And that really sort of banished all hope. We can't send him back to Yemen where bullets are flying and missiles may be overhead.
Yeah, I mean, when you boil down the rationale for this travel ban, Trump will say it's about making America safe. So what do you say to people who are worried that visitors from Yemen will jeopardize the safety and security of the U.S.?
You have an elderly man here. This is real life, who you want to send to face bullets flying in the air for no other reason other than him wanting to be with his family here. And because he's Muslim and Yemeni, what does that say as far as the value of human life for others? Or are only we entitled to that value? That's first and foremost. And then secondly, it's nonsense. Because if you look, I'm sure anyone who wants to really sort of hear and understand the truth, all it takes is a simple Google search. And we see that the real threat is most of the time internally. It has nothing to do with people coming in from Yemen. Yemen had nothing to do with 9/11, for example, and neither are the other countries that are on the list. And so to this entire propaganda, and that's what it is, it's nothing but propaganda, this lie of we're trying to make things secure, it's nothing but deceit.
What have you told your kids? I mean, I think they're looking forward to seeing their grandfather. I mean, has this opened up discussions about the travel ban and about justice?
We talk to them about this a lot. My older children just are saddened by it and understand how unfair that this is. And the younger children can't really wrap their hands around it at all. They can't seem to understand that because their heritage is Yemeni and their grandfather is Yemeni and is Muslim, that somehow he's going to be treated different because for them, they're not different and he's not any different. So it's devastating for them to sort of grow up with this, along with an entire generation of children who must be made to understand that this government is seeing them not as full citizens, not as full Americans who have the right to be with their families. So having to really break that down, to be honest, it's emotional for me because the belief that I've always had in this country is really being tested.
Do you think your kids understand where things are at right now?
Certainly the younger ones don't. The older ones do. But at the end of the day, I think I try not to allow them to feel a sense of helplessness. And I give them the courage to always be proud of their identity and to understand that recourse still remains possible. And that is something that we are going to try to attain through the court system. You know that things are still temporary. This victory is temporary. And we're going to continue to challenge things because that is what our faith teaches us. That is what our government and our history and what America stands for, to stand for what is right and just and equality for all people. And we're not willing to give up on that ideal just yet.
Afaf Nasher is the executive director for the New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thanks for telling us about your father-in-law and what your family is facing now with this travel ban.
Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate the opportunity.
Imagine if your internet service provider, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, imagine if they had the power to determine what content you can see online or how quickly it loads on your phone, computer, whatever device you use. Kind of like paying more to drive in the fast lane on the highway. Net neutrality rules have, for the most part, meant that ISPs have provided equal access to the virtual highway. Those rules were passed under the Obama administration, but Trump's Federal Communications Commission is now moving to dismantle them, and the FCC is set to vote on the proposed rules later this month. As the U.S. seems to be moving away from net neutrality, India is heading in the opposite direction. It took its first big step last year when it banned a service proposed by Facebook called Free Basics. It's a cell phone app that would have given users in India free access to a selection of websites handpicked by Facebook.
essentially what would have happened was that Facebook would have become the entity that becomes a gatekeeper and chooses which sites are free and which sites are not.
That's Nikhil Pawa. He's a digital rights activist who's been a leader in India's fight for net neutrality.
So our opposition essentially was that if they have to give something free, give the whole internet for free, because the internet is not a selection of sites that Facebook picks.
Pawa strongly opposed that idea and was a key player last year in getting India to stop differential pricing for data services.
And what's happened since is that data prices have gone down, data speeds have gone up, and consumers are now actually consuming almost 3 to 4 times of what they used to consume a year ago. That's what happens when you bring in more competition and more players into the market.
And just last week, India's telecommunications regulator published a new set of recommendations aimed at strengthening net neutrality. Pawa told us about that from a street in New Delhi.
Now, the debate that's taking place that this ruling was about was essentially the same one that's taking place in the US about whether certain sites should be available at a faster speed versus others. And the Indian regulators essentially ruled that there needs to be non-discriminatory practices by ISPs where they don't give preferential speeds to one site or the other. And I think that's what the U.S. needs to do.
Many communications companies, though, they already have established different rates for different data speeds for, like, smartphone plans. I recently had the option of upgrading to a faster speed for my phone plan or staying at the current speed. I didn't need more speed, but I'm kind of glad I had the option. And some people do need more speed. From your point of view, what is wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with having a gradation in terms of what kind of speeds you're offering. But what's important is that with the speed that you've chosen, you're able to access whatever you want to access, instead of giving preferential treatment to one site or the other. So think about it this way. If I'm getting a particular speed, I should be free to access either Amazon Prime Video or Netflix. But if you're going to benefit Netflix versus Amazon Prime Video, then there's a problem because you're effectively trying to manipulate user choice. And that's where the problem lies with net neutrality. That net neutrality ensures that ISPs aren't able to manipulate user choice.
So what you're saying is that for AT&T to offer access to, say, direct TV video streaming for free and not counting against your data plan, that's already kind of setting things off balance.
It is. And that's why India has been at the forefront of this battle, because we already have regulations which ban this and essentially disallow any kind of manipulation, because a regulator in India has built these rulings on certain principles of neutrality and not on a case-by-case basis and not on a means of looking at one type of data versus the other from that perspective.
What would the end of net neutrality here mean for internet users?
So I think what it means for internet users is that competition isn't going to be able to come in and build more value proposition for users. So for example, if MySpace had continued under a regime where a Comcast favored them or a AT&T favored them, Facebook would not have been able to become as big as it is today. And so net neutrality ensures that there's free and fair competition on the internet instead of the situation without net neutrality where the ISPs pick winners.
Nikhil Pawa, digital rights activist and founder of the Internet Freedom Foundation in Delhi. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco. Cheers.
Finally today, a quintessential immigrant success story with a sad ending. Lowell Hawthorne, founder and CEO of Golden Crust Caribbean Bakery and Grill, died last Saturday. Police in New York say he committed suicide. Hawthorne came to the U.S. as a young man from his native Jamaica. That was 36 years ago. After a while, he opened a bakery from a single storefront in the Bronx. Over the years, it turned into a successful franchise business with more than 100 locations all over the U.S. Golden Crust is best known for its Jamaican beef patties. The company also distributes frozen patties to thousands of stores nationwide. If you've never had a Jamaican patty, they are delicious. I love them. Flaky yellow dough filled with ground beef or other yummy stuff. They're everywhere in Jamaica, and Lowell Hawthorne had a vision to bring them here. His motto at Golden Crust, "We take the taste of the Caribbean to the world." Hawthorne told his story to our colleagues at the BBC back in 2012.
I was brought up in Jamaica, and my father taught and instilled in us the business, and we actually learned the business from there because my father actually operated a bakery in Jamaica for over 50 years. So all my brothers and sisters were a part of the bakery business there. So I came to the United States in 1981, seeking the American dreams like most immigrants. End up working with NYPD, spent 10 years with the police department. My brothers and my sisters, yes, and their spouses, including my wife, all ventured out to work for different organizations, city, hospitals, and different institutions. But there came a time in my life when I decided, you know what? I want to do what I do best, which is bake. So I pulled them all together and discussed the possibility in going back in the family business, the bakery business. Everyone agreed instantly. And they nominated me to be the president. We were able to pull all our resources together. We came up with approximately $107,000 to start the very first bakery.
Lowell Hawthorne, founder and CEO of Golden Cross Caribbean Bakery and Grill in New York City, speaking with the BBC a few years ago. News of his death this past weekend prompted an outpouring of grief, both in New York and in Jamaica. The Prime Minister of Jamaica offered his condolences on Twitter, but one fan really summed it up with this: "I'm stunned, saddened. Lowell Hawthorne was a fierce entrepreneur, an example of what Jamaicans could achieve in the world through sheer grit and determination." Hawthorne was 57. We thank all of you for being with us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.